continue. And we're now going to turn it over to Guy to start the meeting.
In a couple minutes.
In a couple minutes. We've still got 3 minutes. Okay. And for those who are missing it, she's handing out some little slips of paper that correspond to our astrological signs. So. Now, no, mine's Pisces because mine was yesterday.
Oh, yeah? My wife's is today.
Oh.
She's a Cetus.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Can I turn this around so I can see what I'm supposed to be talking about? Is this connected to anything? Ah, okay.
Guy, I think you might have disconnected.
A loose connection, so it's just a matter of
I touched something.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's just a loose connection. It'll there it goes.
Can I make this a little bit bigger so I can read it better? Is that better? Just on this screen. Mm-hmm. No. You know, if I have to go like this, it's
good. Guy, it's pretty big there.
All right. You see, I have glasses. They're there for a reason. I'm okay.
Hang on, let me see if I can match the.
If I can just get rid of that.
Let me.
Maybe you should take your glasses off.
Take my glasses off. I tried it that way, but it's worse. All right. Thank you so much. Okay, so I think it's 7:30, so we should start. And this is the March 2026 monthly meeting of the National Capital Astronomers. I'm Guy Brandenburg. I'm the current president. If anybody wants to take over from me next year, that'd be just great. We got our vice president, Brian, why don't you raise your hand? Webmaster Elizabeth Warner. Todd is probably
online.
He's online. Can you wave your hand to us?
Right now, because of the way
we got. Okay, we probably can't see you. Sorry about that. And Jim Simpson is not here today. Maybe the same thing. Michael Brabansky, one of our trustees, is here. Zach Lieberman, another trustee. Chong, I don't think, is here. And Elizabeth is our other trustee. I see we have some new people here today. Who do we have that's not been here today, not been here before? Show of hands. Oh, wow. Okay. And how'd you hear about us? Okay. So how many people are here with our speaker? It's quite a few. Okay. Who's new today who's not with our speaker? Okay. How'd you hear about us?
Just an online search. Online search.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Online search also? Anybody else? Okay. Well, thank you. All right. So welcome to everybody, new and old. And we've got some announcements coming up and some upcoming events. And we have a lecture by Dr. Christine, and it's called Under the Same Sky, Omens, Orbits, and Optical Illusions. And maybe telescope app?
There's plenty of hot air in this room that we can maybe use to blow a hole in the clouds, but I'm not hopeful.
Okay. All right. I'm not either. All right. Okay. I don't know if you know this, but today's Pi Day, because here in the U.S. we say 3:14. And if you didn't know, astronomers probably do know, it's the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. It starts 3.14 and so on. And did you know that it's not a very good idea to invite pi to your parties? You know why? Even though pies are great. Do you know why? You know why?
Because it's irrational.
Well, yeah, there's that too. That's right.
Because you're great.
And it goes on and on. Like forever. Okay. Exploring the Sky is going to restart on April 18th. Jay, are you there? Did you want to say anything about that? Guess not. And Sidewalk Astronomy and other public events. Gail, do you want to say something about that?
Well, about a week and a half ago, we had our best and most successful Sidewalk Astronomy event ever. We debuted a new 16.5-inch telescope built by Mr. Brandenburg, and then we had an Obsession 15-inch brought by Dale Gantz. And then it was freaking awesome. We had like 200 people in one night over the course of like 4 or 5 hours. Obsession was pretty awesome.
Bravo.
And we will continue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully once a week, depending on weather, as usual.
Okay. I went to the science fair in Fairfax. It's something called Robinson Secondary School. And it was really impressive. There are some kids doing some amazing work. And from just that, we'll have at least 7 honorees by NCA. And hopefully many of them will come and give us talks in June. The workshop on telescope making modification maintenance continues Tuesdays and Fridays from 6 to 8:45, and as you may have heard, they are going to be destroying that building and rebuilding it. Unfortunately, the community center where we're located, and we've got a lot of stuff, is being downsized. At least that's in the plan, but it's all up in the air as to what there's actually going to happen. I'll talk about the telescope lending library in a bit. If you want to join our listserv, if you're not already on there, that's what you can do. Just send an email to that, capitalastronomers+subscribe@groups.io. And we could still use an assistant secretary treasurer. You know, anybody, it requires almost no work unless Jim Simpson passes away or something like that. All right, and about the eclipse glass, it was a very sad story. We sent several thousand of them to Tunisia, and when they came to their customs, the people in Tunisia, the Tunisian Astronomy Club, they were told they had to pay the full price for these eclipse glasses, which would be several thousand dollars in customs. It was free from us. And they didn't have the money, and we're not going to pay $3,000. So they're sitting there. It's a shame. Okay, lots of upcoming events. We've got Exploring the Sky starting April 18th, March 19th, which is next week. We got a telescope making workshop we're going to present at Chevy Chase, an open house there. On the 25th, we've got Temperance Alley Gardens viewing event. That's in downtown D.C. And the following night, we've got a Maury Elementary presentation on dark skies. The day after that, we've got stargazing here in College Park at Calvert Hills Athletic Fields, not associated with the university. And International Dark Sky Week starts April 13th, and Staunton River Star Party starts in a couple of days, and we're going to have public observing at the Washington Harbor, the dates to be determined, and also at Great Falls and CNO Canal National Park. Again, dates are to be determined still. Sidewalk Astronomy, if you want to join our Google group, because Gail will send out a note saying we're going to be at such and such a location on such and such a date, that's the QR code if you want to take a photo of it. This is our library of telescopes that are available for checkout by NCA members for free, anything from 4 inches up to 12 inches. And that is all I got. So, yes.
One more event coming up will be
the Congressional Cemetery in D.C. is going to be hosting a spring festival on April 26th.
April 26th.
From 11 to 4, that's a Saturday, I believe, and we'll be doing solar observing there for the public. So we'll have hydrogen alpha telescopes, white light telescopes. If you have one of those scopes, feel free to bring them and join us, and it'll be great. It'll be part of the bigger festival.
And April 26th is a popular date. It's going to be 28th Maryland Day. So I'll be at Maryland Day with telescopes.
Okay. Anybody else have announcements?
Not an announcement, but could you put the slide with the sidewalk astronomy QR code back up? I couldn't get my phone out in time.
Okay.
You do need to have a Google account to log into the actual Google group, by the way. So just keep that in mind when you click it. You have to have a Google account.
Okay. All right. That's all I got. And Brian.
All right. Thank you, Guy. So as president of the NCA, it's my honor to welcome tonight's speaker, Dr. Christine Hirst-Bernhardt. I've take a minute to kind of introduce her in terms of her qualifications and really impressive achievements. So as she's getting set up there, we'll kind of embarrass her just a little bit. She spent her career helping students and educators look up at the sky with both wonder and intellectual courage. She's a nationally recognized leader in Earth and space science education and president-elect of the National Earth Science Teachers Association. She currently serves as STEM education coordinator at Nova Systemic, at Northern Virginia Community College, where she helps students and educators alike turn curiosity about the sky into genuine scientific practice. Christine has taught everything from high school earth science to graduate level astronomy, led high altitude balloon programs, and student space symposium. She's also published influential work on how learners develop authentic scientific agency. Her contributions have earned her distinctions such as the Albert Einstein Distinguished Educator Fellowship, the Excellence in Astronomy Teaching Award, and is an ambassador with NASA's SOFIA and the Astronomy in Chile Education Program. She also chairs the U.S. National Astronomy Education Coordinators Team for the IAU and contributes to national efforts to advance science teaching and learning, proving that her orbit in the education world is definitely not elliptical. We're delighted to welcome her for Under the Same Sky, Omens, Orbits, and Optical Illusions, an exploration of how humanity's interpretation of celestial events has evolved from myth to mechanism, and what that shift reveals about our enduring impulse to find meaning in the heavens. Please give a round of applause to Dr. Christine Hirst-Bernhardt.
Don't need closed captioning on me. Wow, thank you. That was quite the introduction. I guess I will not introduce myself.
I think somebody online had the closed captioning, actually. Oh. But that's all right. They'll figure it out.
Well, I understand. I want the closed captioning.
That's all right. They'll turn it back on if they need to.
Okay. I think it has to be done by me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that incredible introduction. I appreciate that. Which means I'm going to skip this slide because that was kind of talking about me. So I am just going to dive right in. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm really excited to share this talk with you. I'm not going to lie, this occupied my entire week. It's been a while since I've been invited to present something new that has not been my research or dissertation that's been just for fun. And the just for fun ended up taking way more time than preparing things related to my research and dissertation. So I really hope you enjoy it. What I always share with students, and when I'm talking to them about astronomy, I share with them what I love most about this science. I feel like this is the only science, and I think you can agree, where we are really addressing these fundamental questions of where do we come from, where are we going, and are we alone? And this is the only science that really provides the answers to those questions. But we're not the first people to answer to ask those questions. And this really comes down to our search for meaning. Frankel, in his 2006 book on cognitive science called Man's Search for Meaning, he described that humans' fundamental need for meaning, even in the most random events, is so strong that it describes our primary motivation to live. In fact, he even looked at these awful situations such as in concentration camps, and that people's search for meaning was tied to their survival, that people that really gave up, which, I mean, I would, in that sort of situation. We're more likely to die from diseases such as typhus, whereas people that found meaning and were able to latch on to something higher or more purposeful had a higher higher probability to survive. So across cultures, the sky has carried meaning too. And in some cases, this really meant life or death. This could have meant places to move to, seasons for planting. And in some cases, if you happen to be the astrologer for hire in, say, a royal society, if you got your predictions wrong, you were probably going to be beheaded. And it could have meant your cultures or your societies or your family clans' survival. And for harvest, for migration. And there's always been this reverence for planets and really a fear of events. So we can see across cultures such as native sky watchers. This is from the Misipichu tribe, which is close to the Cree tribe in Minnesota. So a constellation that we're pretty familiar with, the Big Dipper, they would actually describe this as a sweat lodge. We can see the native sky watchers, their orientation of a star chart, which has some things that might be familiar, some things that are really unique to them. And what we know as Orion, they would actually describe as a giant that was there for peace, not that was hunting, which we describe him as. We can see that if we look at cultures in Aboriginal Australia, they actually didn't look for the alignment of stars at all. They looked for dust clouds and spaces between some of those positions. So that was where they drew their meaning from. So they looked for dust lanes. And it's not hard to imagine why. Are you going to play for me? I have a lot of things that need to play. It's not hard to imagine why. There we go. Yay, it worked. It's not hard to imagine why when we think about the perspective. And that's really what it comes down to. When we observe that it appears from our perspective that we see something like the sun as traveling along this background of stars. And we can now know that that is called the ecliptic. So I'm going to refer to that throughout my talk. You didn't know that? Oop, ignore that. Change. Going off of multiple screens here. I apologize. There we go. So humans have always looked for patterns in the sky. And I told you that that was the ecliptic. We see the sun passing through each of these different zodiacal signs. And in the Babylonian times, the sky was divided amongst 12 different portions with the constellation that was found along the ecliptic. And that was how the earliest calendrical system was devised. So 12 months passing through each of those different 12 zodiacal signs. So I gave each of you who are here early enough a little piece of paper. In just a second, you are going to take a look at that. But you are going to need, this is an interactive presentation. I taught high school. I got to keep kids awake. You are going to go to, on your phone, Slido, S-L-I-D-O, and it is going to ask you for a code. You can also scan that, and this is the code. So in a second, you're going to, once you get on there, you're going to look at that little piece of paper I gave you. Don't let anyone else see it. And then rate how accurate that was. Those of you that just came in, if you want to tell me real quick what your sign is.
April, so.
Aries?
Taurus?
Aries or Taurus? One of the two. What's your birthday?
28.
I have more Taurus. Oh, we got someone did not feel like it fit for them at all.
She said to wait.
There we go. There's Taurus. Here you go. Did you get one? What's your sign? Okay, we got a couple people that say it's right on. There's a Scorpio. And again, don't let anyone else see yours.
Look at them.
Yes, you can look at them, just don't let anyone else see them. Virgo? Yep, look at yours. Don't let anyone else see it.
This is the same as my fortune cookie the other day.
Oh, wow.
The fortune cookie was better.
I will tell you, when I ask high school students this, they all say five. Once you've read it, take a peek at your neighbors. You're right, it's the same. So those of you online, I gave everyone exactly the same one. I tricked you because we're meaning seekers. And I've done this before where I've mixed them all up and people have found profound meaning in something that there really isn't meaning to because that's what our brains do, because that is human nature. Surprise. We've done this forever. So during the Renaissance period, astrology was actually considered the queen of the sciences. It was used to explain birth, death, the decline of everything, and the planets in the zodiac were linked to the divine and the physical world. In fact, this picture shows John Dee, who was an English mathematician. He was an advisor to Queen Elizabeth, and he really helped shape early navigation. He pursued alchemy, angelic communication, and he was an advisor to the queen. So he was a pretty high-ranking dude. He was one of the most learned men of his time, very trusted. He coined the phrase British Empire, which we've all probably heard of, and he really envisioned England's global influence around the scientific age. He came up with this hierarchy here of the divine realm, the celestial realm, the earthly realm, and the elemental realm. And astrology really fit into this structure because the planets in the zodiac acted as intermediaries between the divine and the material worlds. And astrology assigns meaning to the planet that is overhead when you're born. So astrologers note that planets at birth map to a person's psychological, emotional, behavioral blueprint, indicating your personality, your strengths, life challenges, bloody, bloody, blah, blah, blah. And that can have transformative, life-changing events. So much so that 70 million people actually read this every single day. 25% believe that the celestial position has some influence over their daily life. And sadly, for me as a science teacher, 34% believe that it is very or kind of scientific.
Come on. That's 34% of the 70 million?
34% of the public.
Of the public.
Of the public.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S. So, in 2011, there was a very funny thing that Allstate Insurance put out that showed, based on your sign, so remember when, those of you who are Virgo, when I laughed at you, you get more accidents than anyone else does. So Allstate actually published this and linked your zodiacal sign to your accident proneness and said that they were going to rate people's insurability on their zodiacal sign. People didn't like that very much. And 2 days later, they had to release a correction. But they originally, they said Virgos have the most crashes, and then they had to really backtrack and they had to correct that. And they said, actually, there's no significance to that. We did that for, you know, entertainment purposes. Because statistically, when we control for things like age and driving exposure, we don't see any of that. But even in these really, really big data sets, we can find these spurious correlations when we look for meaning. We can even see this in places like the stock market. There are people that do astrological trading. So you can see this is a chart that shows things like conjunctions and planetary positions. This is actually used. Like, you can look up astrological trading. I learned something new when I was preparing for this talk. There's even been times that astrology has influenced politics. So after Ronald Reagan, his attempted assassination in 1981, Nancy Reagan looked to a pretty famous astrologer named Joan Quigley. And she sought her advice, and they used her guidance through his entire presidency to be able to map their travel. So this wasn't linked to political decisions, so they say. This was exposed in a PBS documentary that I'll link to at the end. But they actually found that their travel was entirely linked to the zodiacal charts. And I'll zoom in on this. So here, if you can see, that is the astrological calculations for Ronald Reagan. And up here, oh, that's a bummer that that's in the way. But that's Nancy Reagan right there. And this is all of their travel. So the Sky Watchers of thousands of years ago also attributed some meaning to the alignments of the planets. So Sky Watchers forever have noted that there were these wandering stars that we now know are called planets. In fact, the term planet means wandering star. So they knew that if you could predict or determine where these planets were going to be, that must mean that there was something significant in that. And people have noted forever. Are you going to play? Good. people have noted that there have been times when it appears as though the planets appear together in this in space and time. This was the planetary parade in Sky and Telescope. If you might recognize this, this was on their website last year. I stole it. And this might have been what would have seen one would have seen during the 2025 planetary parade. And again, people have looked at things like this and attributed meaning. In 1524, in the early 1500s, astrologers predicted a catastrophic flood. There was an alignment of Jupiter and Saturn. There was an astrologer, because astrologers, astronomers were synonymous. Most of them were also priests. And with this prediction, this astrologer named Stoeffler, he claimed that the alignment was going to trigger this massive rainfall. There was going to be a huge flood all over Europe. In fact, there was this massive panic that that people embarked on, and they began building boats. People all over Europe began building boats. Even the nobles prepared for a mass exodus. But when that day arrived, it was pretty dry. Too bad. But even as early as, or as recently as the year 2000, there was a planetary alignment. And these are just some news headings that I found. March 2023, this alignment could mean your star sign is at the end of the world. If you remember in Y2K, if you're old enough, yes, I dated myself, around Y2K, there was also this planetary alignment that people were looking at. And, oh my gosh, the world is going to end. So these are all of the press clippings that I found. Astrologers predict alignment chaos. Planetary alignment didn't end the world in 1919, but one professor thought it would. This was on CNN. Scientists, no doomsday in store. When planets align. So people had to actually like backtrack. Scientists had to make statements like the world is actually not going to end, people. It's okay, calm down. But because ancient observers have always recognized these patterns in the sky, astrology really attempted to interpret those patterns. But astronomy asked a different question. What were the processes that produced these patterns? Excuse me. So astrology was really seen as the science that connected heaven and earth and explained the harmony of the cosmos. But as the science shifted towards physical laws and mechanical causation, astronomy was what replaced this symbolic interpretation with mechanism. So Carl Sagan pointed out that astrology makes claims that sound scientific but have no mechanism. So the zodiac chart interprets patterns, but astronomy explains those same objects through motion, gravity, and physics. And if we look at something like the celestial sphere, when we consider this model, obviously this is not the way space is, but when we consider this model of like a bowl over our head that contains everything we see, the stars, the galaxies, it becomes a little easier to understand how the ancients understood these events. We now understand how fast light moves, how long it takes for light to get from stars to us, from the sun to us. And we now understand that what we see is actually a projection effect. Even the constellation Orion would look differently if you were on the moon. You wouldn't see it like that at all, because in fact, the center belt star is 1,000 light years further away than the other two stars. So what we're seeing is a projection of those things from our place in time, from our perspective. It's a projection. It's not the way it actually is. And if we look at those stars in Orion based on their distance, they're not together at all. And what we see is also dependent on our physical location. So you guys are amateur astronomers. You probably know the concepts of altitude and azimuth. So altitude is how far we look up in the sky. Azimuth is our degrees around a circle. And where we are on Earth depends on how we determines how we see, say, the sun or a planet based on its background. So vantage point A and B, we're looking at the same object but different background stars. And we've all probably heard that the ancients used astronomy as navigation. Remember I said that altitude is up and down. So if we think about our fingers, this is about 25 degrees. Here's about 10 degrees. And if we were to stack our fists, we are at, oh, I'm not in California anymore. What's our latitude?
39.
Thank you. 39 degrees. That is where you'll see Polaris. All right. We have another Slido in just a second. So be ready. So quick quiz. You astronomers are you better win this next one. So we know that things rise in the east, transit in the south, set in the west. If we're looking north, we're going to see star trails that look circumpolar. So they're going to be circumnavigating around our pole star. And the ancients mapped this. So they knew that if they were looking a certain direction, what the star trails would actually look like. Now we have awesome things like cameras where we can track these things. So a couple fun things here. What direction are you facing?
Oh, Jesus.
Come on, astronomers. Don't get it wrong. This is the easy one.
Wait, is it in the picture or
in the picture?
Right now?
Okay. In the picture. Assuming you took that photo, what direction are you facing? And if you go to Slido and you put in that number, there will be a few more. So if you are, assuming you're not scrolling the internet, my son in the back, it should keep this up. So this would have been a long exposure. This was always a test question on my tests.
If you can't answer to, you can't.
Oh, I see where you're going. Northern Hemisphere. I should have given that caveat.
Okay, Northern Hemisphere. All right.
You outsmarted the future.
Well.
Sorry. That, yeah, South went down.
Oh.
All right. Ding, ding, ding. It is North because that is Polaris. So that's probably about our latitude, right? Mm-hmm. Looks about that. Mid-latitude.
I can't see Polaris, so that's what was throwing.
The center.
Yeah. All right. I said south because I couldn't see.
Next one, a little tougher. What direction are you facing?
Oh, from the northern hemisphere.
Northern hemisphere.
You can't say like southeast or something.
You need some in between up names.
Sorry. At the bottom, that should have said, I have no idea. But somehow my fingers were obviously tired. Or maybe you can see it better on your phone. That should have been what it was. Good. Most of you guys got that. That is east. We rise in the east, transit in the south, set in the west. Yes, I know those are a little tougher. So astronomy allows us to describe the zodiac correctly. So I gave you guys all your signs. Even if I hadn't have given you all the exact same one, it would have all been wrong because modern astrology is physically incorrect. It can't be correct because there are actually 13 zodiacal signs. If you were born in early December, you are actually not Sagittarius. You are Ophiuchus. You probably, yay, we have an Ophiuchus.
Nope.
Son, you are an Ophiuchus. You are not a Sagittarius. So Ophiuchus is our 13th zodiacal sign, but that doesn't fit the model because we don't have 13 months. So even the Babylonians threw that out. And when the 88 constellations were adopted, the Society of Astrology threw that one out too. But there are in fact 13 zodiacal signs on the zodiac, on the actual zodiacal signs along the ecliptic. And there's other reasons that astrology is incorrect. Our pole star is actually different. Right now our pole star is thank you. It used to be Vega. That's why our dog is named Vega, guys. Vega used to be our pole star. So this picture is pretty darn exaggerated. Earth does wobble, so our pole star has changed because Earth's axis has shifted. About every 26,000 years, we wobble like a top, so about 13,000 years, we're pointed in a different direction, but it's only about 3 degrees. This is pretty darn exaggerated. Now, Mars does that. Mars's axis of rotation and precession is much more like that. And Mars does not have a large gravitational moon to retain its orbital orientation. So it actually swings pretty wildly and a lot more frequently. Ours is a bit more moderate, but we're not pointed towards the same North Star anymore. So that sign also changes over time. And like I showed you back with the Allstate, we go through each of those zodiacal signs at different periods. So Virgo, the reason there are more accidents in Virgo is the sun is in Virgo for 45 days, where it is only in Aries, I think, for like 7.
Oh.
Yeah.
So
during the ancient Egyptian times, their North Star, I think, was called
Thea. Thea was the impactor that hit Earth and formed the moon.
It's Thuban.
Thuban, yeah. Thea is definitely astronomically important. So, looking now at alignments. The reason that alignments happen go back to the way that the solar system was actually created. So how we see the sky is a function of actually how it was formed. So the planets were formed from this condensing solar nebula that was probably triggered by a nearby supernova. So there had to be something in space that caused that cloud of gas and dust to condense into our sun in the first place. So it condensed gravitationally. It retained all of that material in a disk due to the conservation of angular momentum, like an ice skater spinning. And it was born from that disk. As it collapsed, that disk then expelled material out, which became the planets. But essentially, the planets all remain in a plane because of that disk in that moment of formation. Mm-hmm. I do not want to jinx it, but I haven't had any tech issues yet. So this is... So the reason we see that alignment is because when that disk formed, it drew everything into essentially the same plane. And we're in that plane too. Come on. There we go. And just little fun facts, because the sun expelled material the way it did, we had the condensed denser material inside the frost line. We had the lower dense density materials and the gases that condensed outside. So fun fact, if you had a bathtub big enough to float Saturn, it would actually float. Even though it is significantly more massive, it has a significantly lower density, is less dense than water, is denser than one, or less dense than one. And it would actually float, whereas Mercury would sink, even though it is smaller. So if we look at the orbital plane of the planets, we can actually see that they're generally all in the same plane. So if we were to look, that top one is looking west, we could always see Mercury and Venus right above the horizon. If we were looking east, we could see here, if we were in another portion of the world, and we can see that each of the planet's orbits is pretty darn close to that plane. Mercury is actually, interestingly enough, the closest tilt, or the highest degree of tilt. So when astronomers talk about alignment, what they actually mean is a line of sight effect. So again, think about that projection effect. So we're not talking about proximity, we're talking line of sight. So from Earth, looking outward, this is actually what we would see. So a couple of weeks ago, we had another planetary parade. This might have been what you would have seen. Doesn't really look like a straight line. Last year, this would have been about how it looked. So the planetary parade, there was about 5 planets. We can see where the ecliptic is, and they're pretty darn close to the ecliptic. But true alignments are actually pretty darn rare. What we're usually seeing is just our line of sight effect, but there's also things called conjunctions. Conjunctions are where they are actually very, very close to in the sky, and looks like they might actually be touching. But remember, this is still a line of sight effect. So they're not in a straight line. And it's actually really not rare. Because they all exist in this orbital plane, we see this pretty darn frequently. And conjunction is where they appear only a couple degrees apart, but again, it's still a line of sight. There is no connection to natural disasters, there's no gravitational effects, no astrological significance, and really the next true alignment is gonna be in the 2040s. But we have had them before. In fact, this is what really enabled the age of planetary exploration and the Voyager missions, was because we had an alignment. This was the last true alignment in 77, which enabled us, using gravitational slingshots, because the planets happen to be actually close together in their orbits, to take what we now know as the greatest pictures in the solar system, which we've really never been able to replicate. So that was enabled by a planetary alignment. All right. I have another question for you. So this is a question that was made famous by Carl Sagan that I had to calculate out in all of its entirety in grad school. He posed the question, if astrology is so significant, what had a greater gravitational force over you when you were born, Mars or your OBGYN? Mom's OBGYN. Do you see? Can I see what you see on your phone real quick? Okay. Are you able to put in your answer?
That's for our name.
Oh, okay, because I made this one a quiz.
What's the question?
The question is, what object had the greatest gravitational influence over you at birth?
I guess you would have a large gravitational influence on yourself.
Something else.
No, Lily said just name.
Yeah.
I don't see.
And there was no question. It was
okay. All right. Well, that's
your name, and then the next thing it says, get ready.
Oh, there we go.
I formatted this one differently. Sorry. The next one will probably do the same thing. There we go. Don't choose option 5.
Voting closed.
It says voting closed.
Oh. Oh, darn it. Okay. Well, let's just go to the answer.
We jinxed it. Sorry.
I did. I'm sorry. All right. So the classic OBGYN versus Mars question. So we know that gravity is dependent on mass and distance, but in this case, in terms of planets, distance is really the moderator. So that's the biggest factor. So even though Mars is massive, it is really, really far away. So if we look at tidal influences over Earth, we can see all of these different objects. And compared to the moon, if we think about the moon as our baseline, as we get further and further away, how much weaker these get? We can just use Newton's law of mutual gravitation. We can see that Mars is 360,000 times weaker than Earth. There's that simple equation again. And we know that the obstetrician, if we are thinking about them being about a half a meter away, they would exert 50 times more gravitational force on the newborn than Mars does. And if you here happen to teach undergrads, that is a fun math problem to give to students because they have to know that the orbit is not circular and the distances and the average. It's a lot more math than you think. That one took me an hour to calculate. So there are actual gravitational effects, and we see this when we think about tides. So tides actually do exert a gravitational effect, and it's not just the moon on us, it's actually us on the moon. So over time, we now know that we have actually pulled the core of the moon to where the backside of the moon is significantly thicker than the near side of the moon. So we know the near side is having all of these craters, but the backside of the moon, the far side, does not look like that at all. And that's largely because of our gravitational effect over time on the moon itself. So for thousands of years, we know that we have interpreted these messages from the sky. And astronomy has replaced these interpretations with mechanisms, these physical processes that explain what we actually see. But there are some mechanisms that are really important to explain sky's motion. Earth's rotation, the daily motion, we know this as a
sidereal day.
We'll just call it a day, but yes. And revolution, which we know as, well, rotation. We rotate around a body, that's not a day. Rotation is the, oh yes, I'm sorry, rotation is a day. Revolution is a
year.
Good. Not actually a year, it's 365.25 days, which is why we have to have a leap year. And a sidereal day is the actual time of the rotation as well. So this is really what governs most planetary motion and gravity. We know that planetary orbits are really what govern the way things move in space. So once we understand these concepts, the sky suddenly becomes pretty darn predictable. And people have been trying to do this for a long time. So we know that these planetary models have really grown and changed as people's knowledge has evolved and changed. So as we've refined our tools, our models have changed. So initially we had models from Brahe, who was one of our first observers, had one of the very first observatories. He made these very distinct and very very accurate notations of where the planets were. Then Kepler really inherited those observations. And from that, he came up with these positions of where the planets were. And it has always been thought of that the planets moved in these perfect circles. Circles were this divine sphere, and the Greeks really believed that circles represented perfection and divine order. We then had Ptolemy, who also made these observations, but he observed these planets as moving backwards, because remember that at this point, even though everything was thought to be in circles, it was the Earth at the center. And that became really complicated, because when we place the Earth at the center, we start to see that things like Mars have places in the orbit where they travel backwards. So it becomes incredibly complicated, because then it meant that Venus had to travel backwards in places too, but not the same. And then Jupiter had to travel backwards. So it got really complicated really, really quickly. So Copernicus then changed that, made it much more simple. There we go. And then Kepler refined these models by saying that orbits are not circles at all. They're actually ellipses. And because they're ellipses, we know that the Earth's orbit is actually the closest to being circular. Mercury, which is also the most inclined, is also the most elliptical. And because of that, we can name these places in the orbits perigee and apogee, close to the sun, further away from the sun, or close to Earth and further away from Earth. And that has consequences for how we observe things. So Kepler then created these laws of planetary motion. Orbits are ellipses. They move over different places in the orbit, equal speeds at different times. And then that gave us the ability to calculate distance. But then that was further refined when Newton described why planets move that way. Kepler gave us the observations, but he really didn't give us the mechanism. So Newton gave us the why. He explained that the same force that holds an apple in orbit, or an apple, the same force that holds an apple also holds the moon in orbit. And one of those physical laws explains both the earth and the heavens. So he explained that if we were to shoot something out of a cannon, if we shot it fast enough, it's never going to fall. That's what an orbit is. So an orbit is really just that balance between gravity pulling inward and motion carrying the planet forward. And from Newton, in the Newton's laws clearly described that gravity clearly, oh my goodness, I'm sorry, it's been a really long day. Newton's laws describe gravity extremely well and allowed astronomers to predict positions. But then Einstein came along and showed that gravity wasn't actually a force pulling across space, but that massive objects are warping space and time, and that bigger objects are going to place a greater force or a hole in space-time, like a black hole, which is an infinite hole in space-time. So Newton really talked about how the planets moved, and Einstein described the why. And for another fun one, when is the northern hemisphere closer to the sun?
No, it's not your question.
It's just not intuitive.
No, it's not intuitive. Yeah.
Another second. I'll give you a couple options here. Interesting. Wow. Okay. Some of you got that right. The northern hemisphere is actually closer to the sun during winter. So it would be at its closest point on the winter solstice. So the orbital position is not why we have the seasons. It's obviously because of tilt. But remember that the Earth's orbit is elliptical. So that means there are places in its orbit when it's closer or further away from the sun. We just happen to be 50,000 kilometers closer to the sun during winter. During Yeah, so it would be opposite in the southern hemisphere.
No, it's the same.
No, it's the same. It'll be the
same.
Yes. Yeah, so January in the northern hemisphere, it's going to be tilted away. Yeah, so in the southern hemisphere, it'd be the same.
They're experiencing summer.
That they're experiencing summer.
They're experiencing a harsher summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get hit with a double whammy.
So over time, astronomy has shifted from describing patterns to explaining those things with physical laws. And eclipses have always been things that have signaled cosmic warnings, supernatural events, things like devouring the sun. They've been omens for kings and empires, and many cultures performed many rituals in order to restore the sun. And if you've never had the opportunity to see one, it is pretty darn amazing. And pretty easy to see why a culture would attribute such meaning to seeing their sun disappear. Seems pretty supernatural. You guys seen a solar eclipse?
Mm-hmm.
Had one here recently.
It looks like
awesome. Yeah, that was an annual. So in 585 BC, there was a battle between the Lydians and the Medes, and the sun suddenly darkened. Which both sides took as a sign to stop battle, and they actually did, and went home. Doesn't usually end that way. Much more tragically, in 1504, Columbus landed in Jamaica, and he actually was able to predict, he knew that there was going to be an eclipse. His army was out of food, so he used this to manipulate the local people into giving him food. He eventually conquered them, took over where they lived, and took many lives because he told them that if he didn't follow their orders, he was going to take away the sun. They believed him because it would have seemed that he had supernatural powers to actually be able to do that. We can see that eclipses have been predicted for a really long time. This is the Dresden Codex. Cortez most likely stole this and took it back, and it was found in a museum. This is the oldest Mayan writings. And this shows that they had actually been predicting eclipses for 700 years. Um, for time's sake, I'm just going to skip ahead of this guy. Sorry. And we can see that there are cultures all over. This is Chichen Itza, where we can see the equinox also had some, the equinox and the solstices. So there's a snake climbing up Chichen Itza. And we can see at the equinox that the sun aligned perfectly within that temple. But really, solar eclipses are just a model of perfect fractions. So my math teachers in here, my math people, solar eclipses are really the intersection of observation, pattern seeking, and crazy cosmic coincidences. So the sun is 400 times larger than the moon, but it's also 400 times further away. So because of that, they appear the same size. We can all agree that the moon and the sun are not the same size, right? But we see them the same size. I mean, it's crazy that the sun that is so much bigger can block out the moon that is so much smaller, which is only because of these perfect proportions and this perfect place in time. Because we are actually losing the moon at the same rate that your fingernails grow. So in about 270 million years, we won't have eclipses at all because the moon will be too far away. And 270 million years ago, we wouldn't have because the moon would have been too close. So we are in a perfect place in time and a perfect place in the solar system to observe eclipses. And we are most likely the only place that we have observed that has solar eclipses. So going back to our orbits again, remember that orbits are not perfect circles, they are ellipses. So the size that we see the moon depends on where we and it is at in its orbit. So when we're around the sun, we call it perihelion. When it's around us, we call it perigee. We put an A in front of it, it means the opposite. So apogee, apihelion means it's further away. So if you have ever seen a supermoon or thought the moon looked bigger, it's because it probably was, because half of the time in its orbit, it is going to appear closer. So when there is a supermoon, that means it is about 50,000 kilometers closer to us. It appears about 13% bigger to our eyes. And we can see the side-by-side comparison. And also when we are closer to the sun, that is obviously going to change the size that the sun looks. And we call this angular diameter because we only see one portion of it. We only see the disk side. So they have the same angular diameter. So we can see at perigee and apogee of the moon, we can see that actual size difference. It is notable. So when we have a supermoon eclipse, it is special and it does appear much bigger because it is closer. But we only have these eclipses on a predictable cycle because the moon's orbit is also inclined. So the moon has to be on a node where it is intersecting the plane of our orbit, which only happens at regular intervals, which people like the Maya and the Chinese were able to accurately predict. And when it's not on the node, which we can see on both sides, we don't have that perfect alignment of the shadows to give us that effect. And just for fun, in case you've ever had a hard time explaining what the equinoxes are, watch the line of the shadow. So you can see right there where it's vertical, that's an equinox. Mm-hmm. At the furthest point, that's a solstice. Equinox, there we go. Yeah, that is the best description I have ever found. There we go. So lastly, I want to talk to you guys for a minute about my favorite thing, what I did my second master's in, which is space rocks. They are the coolest. Meteorites are really just pieces of asteroids that survive their fall through Earth's atmosphere and land on the ground. But to ancient observers, these were literally stones that fell from the sky. So first I have a question for you. This is your last, you have one more after this.
What's the question?
Why is the question not showing up?
It's asking for our names again.
I am sorry. The question is, have you seen a shooting star? Raise your hand if you've seen a shooting star. You're all wrong. You have not. Stars do not fall. Oh, there we go. Come on, there we go. So before we can talk about my favorite thing, space rocks, quick little vocab check. Asteroids are when it is orbiting in space, has not crossed into our atmosphere. A meteoroid is that small rock fragment that is traveling through space. A meteor is the light that we see, the phenomena as it's burning up in the atmosphere. And a meteorite is when it lands on Earth's surface. All the same thing, different locations.
And we get so many people coming to us with their media wrongs, it's not even...
There's a lot of media wrongs. And that's because 70,000 meteors land on the ground all the time, but they're really hard to find. So, I mean, we've had a lot of those impacts, but only about 4% of those that fall are actually irons and the ones that we really care about. But there's a lot of links to these. So iron in some modern languages is actually related to the term for fire from heaven or fire from sky. And in ancient Egypt, their term for sky or for star was the same as their word for iron. So ancient peoples knew that there was a connection between these. So culturally, these have been really significant. So we know that there's about 17,000 meteors that weigh more than 50 grams, but most of these are stones. Only about 4% are irons. By iron, I mean they have a really high concentration of iron and nickel, significantly higher than anything that could ever be found on Earth. There's just no terrestrial processes that could actually create those. So the oldest known iron artifacts are these beads in Egypt. They're about 55,000 years old, and those are meteoric iron. And we know that because they have less carbon and they have higher nickel and higher iron. So there are ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics where the term for iron seems to be derived from a phrase meaning iron from the sky. This is a dagger that was found in a Hittite settlement from about 2300 BC. And these are the cuneiform tablets that were from the Assyrian colonial site in Turkey, which refer to sky metal. So ancient people knew that there was something significant falling from the sky. And they knew these were a valuable commodity. And in fact, the tablet actually signifies that these stones were more valuable than silver, which was the most valuable thing at the time. So there is a treasure of Valena in Spain, where they have all of these golden jewels. There's like 66 different golden things. But then there's these objects that look kind of unassuming, which are the oldest iron remnants that they found in the Iberian Peninsula. So this is pretty significant because that means that they actually made this into jewelry. So this has been used all over the world. So it may not be as eye-catching, but can you imagine putting an iron, you know, crown on? That does not sound very fun to me. These have also played into our myths. So the working class gods of Thor and Vulcan would have used this iron from heaven. The god of thunder, blacksmith's hammer, that would have been meteoric iron. So these myths actually came from rock falling from the sky, which meant a god would have had to have yielded those tools. So those working class gods were literally using meteoric iron as their tools. So the hieroglyphics for star and iron are actually linked together, and they think that you would use them synonymously. And this really became a goal because this was such a hard metal. This became a goal that really was the impetus for metallurgy and being able to smelt iron. This was what is used in the mythical Excalibur. This was thought to be real magic. Meteoric iron was indestructible. It was incorruptible. It was really powerful, which is why the gods would have used it. So there was this strong incentive to be able to develop this iron and smelt it, which once they invented that many years later, they were able to use this much easier. But probably the most famous is King Tut's dagger. So the dagger that he was found with is meteoric iron. But remember, there was no smelting. So they would have had to actually hammer this guy, which would have been really, really difficult because this is significantly higher iron content than what we could physically smelt ourselves. So it was hammered. So this is actually linked to a meteorite fall that we know of in Egypt. So we have found other remnants that have the same spectrographic signature as this dagger. So astronomy is really good at explaining how these patterns occur. We know that orbital mechanics, planetary formation, why the sun and the moon appear the same size in our sky, but explaining the mechanism doesn't really eliminate the meaning. For many people, understanding the physics actually deepens a sense of wonder about our universe and the place within it. So when we think about things like our habitable zone, our perfect location in the solar system, our perfect location in our galaxy, we know that there has to be some, or we like to think that there has to be some meaning for that. But that doesn't mean that all of our pattern seeking is correct. We've gotten this wrong many times. In fact, one of the most famous was Giovanni Schiaparelli reported that he saw canals on Mars. And it wasn't until, and Percival Lowell actually popularized this and built a whole observatory to be able to investigate these canals on Mars. And it wasn't until the Mariner mission that we showed that those were actually not canals at all. But that actually went into George Orwell's 1984. Some of the very first pictures of Mars demonstrated that there was a face. This provoked a whole uproar about the face on Mars. Maybe you guys have seen this. This is from the Viking 1 lander in 1976. Gained a lot of fame for looking like a human face. It does kind of look like a human face. It sparked all sorts of theories of alien monuments. But when we sent the Curiosity mission there, this is actually what it looks like. But our brain wants to find meaning. Humans really wanted to believe that that was a face on Mars. Maybe you've seen this before. Do you see her as young or old? It's one of my favorites. I'm reading The Seven Habits in this book. There's no wrong answer. However you see her, tell your brain it's the other one and see if you can flip it. You might have to close your eyes or look away for a second. Because our brains latch onto a pattern and sometimes we have to trick it.
Just as long as you don't do the black dress.
The blue dress. I thought about putting that one up. Too controversial. I see her as young too, and I have to work really hard to see her as old. I'm sure there's some science as to why we see what we see. Maybe it's because I'd like to think I'm young. But we're naturally pattern seeking. That's our unique position as meaning making creatures. We're the only creatures that do that. There's no other creatures that look beyond the proximal of the day to day. We're the only ones. Maybe there's a meaning there. We have to plan over longer horizons, over bigger goals. So that's where we need more overarching things, moral, religious, ideological, to give meaning and planning to our enterprises. So in other words, the need for meaning comes from our uniquely human capacity for foresight. So the meaning of our life becomes the ultimate goal. Our existential questions are really just outgrowths of the more general drives to find causes in our daily life, and the events are to find patterns in the world. We've always looked to the sky for meaning. What astronomy gives us is something just as powerful, understanding. The sky didn't lose its wonder when we learned how it works. If anything, it gained it. Thank you. That's my LinkedIn, and all you academics, there's my references. Ryan.
So I got two questions, but I'll ask one first. So in terms of the public perception of science, right? I understand obviously in the ancient world we didn't have the scientific method. We didn't have these explanations. So people found meaning in patterns, like you were saying, where they could, right? And so they created stories and rich mythology and so forth. Today we're post the scientific revolution, if you like. We're past the age of enlightenment. But yet we seem to be regressing a little bit. And you see large portions of the population, and you alluded to that, that don't seem to be satisfied with scientific explanations for things and are going back to the sort of magical thinking. Mm. In your opinion, why is that? And what can we do to change that?
Because gosh. That's a question every educator asks themselves every day.
Sure.
You know, it's a tough one. I think we have so many competing interests. There's so many competing things for our attention. You know, the computer in our pocket. It's rewired our brains. I'm actually really interested in the cognitive connections of the rewiring of our brains from our diverted attention, from just the distractions from our phones. So I think there's so many ways that one could answer that. For me, as an educator, as a parent, I think a lot of it is that we are looking to things to do tasks that used to take brain power. And, you know, just like anything, you don't use it, you lose it. And if we are relying on machines, whatever that machine is, to do our thinking, mm-hmm. we're going to lose that muscle. So over time, we have generations that are not using the tools that our ancestors used. So I think a lot of it goes to that. We could talk all day about societal distrust of science, which is a whole other topic. But if we just think about what's happening at the cognitive level, we're seeing people don't need to search for things. Mm-hmm. Even searching for information is so much easier. They don't have to think about things as long. You know, if I think about, you know, that math problem I gave you with the OBGYN and Mars, like if you had to hand calculate that, that takes a lot more mental enterprise than it does to put it in a calculator, mm-hmm. and or to ask ChatGPT. You know, so when we offload our mental tasks, we lose the ability over time to do those tasks, mm-hmm. and over time we don't have those resources to draw from. So, you know, without going into the many societal issues, I would say that cognitively, that's what we're seeing.
I would just comment a little bit on your answer. I think a lot of modern science, a lot of the technology today, seems a little bit like magic because it's so complex that maybe you don't understand it, and then it's equivalent to magic in the old days.
Yeah.
But my question for you is, you mentioned about the superstitions associated with the astronomical events, and the ecliptic is a very big thing, the constellations along the ecliptic. But how do we know where the sun, I mean, in the ancient days, of course, now we do, but we say that the sun is in Aries or this constellation or that, but you can't see Aries when the sun's out, right?
So
how did they know back in those days in which constellation the sun was?
That's a really observant question because, yeah, obviously you wouldn't have seen the sun in a nighttime constellation. So my understanding is there were just really, and maybe someone else can answer this better than me, but from what I've seen of just the documentation, there were just really in-depth records. So, you know, knowing at night where it would be, and then I guess lining up where they thought where the sun was during the day, and just night after night after night, taking meticulous records. And what I used to always tell my students is, you know, if there wasn't TV, you were looking at the stars. That was your TV. That was your entertainment. Does anyone have a better answer?
Well, you can almost see what constellation you're in, like at sunrise and sunset.
Sure.
Because you've got the stars, so they can see the pattern, and they know the sun's getting ready to come up.
So
they can kind of guesstimate where it was, mm-hmm. and see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Extrapolate.
Yeah.
Something that I've heard, I don't know all that much about astrology, but I've heard people talk about rising signs and setting signs.
You already have said more than I know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But just thinking about, like, if they were looking at that, like, the constellation is in Aries, maybe that was when it was, like, rising and setting. Like, look at, I'm just trying to respond to it.
I used to always start my class with, I actually have a whole lesson on that Allstate thing, and I would show students like the actual graphs and the time that the sun was in each of those constellations, because I would want them to come to their own determination of like, wow, 7 days, 45 days, like that's not a month. And I would want them to come to that. I've had students cry like that they have put so much faith in astrology and it's all wrong. And a Fuchsius, oh my gosh, that's just like too much for their brains to handle. And still, I taught this class for a whole year, and I had a student at the very end of the year be like, oh, I loved your astrology class so much. Oh, you know nothing. Any other questions?
Sure.
Yeah.
So a couple of months ago, I heard a story about how stories and actual scientific understanding is passed down generation after generation over thousands and thousands of years. One of my favorite examples is how the North Star seems to change over many, many, many generations, and that determines like the actual position of the axis of the Earth. What do you know of that stuff, and what do you think about it? The story,
as far as the stories,
and in the Southern Hemisphere, like that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we know that stories get passed on. I did a lot of work with Native American tribes in Northern California. Spent a bit of time with many of them, and I'm really fascinated by a lot of Native American stories. And Native Sky Watchers is actually a group that I'm a part of. And it's fascinating to me honestly, the similarity between cross cultures looking at the same things and how they come up with similar stories. You know, so many of them tied to creation stories and their identity stories. That is fascinating to me. And there are many cultures that didn't have a written language, where their whole language, everything was passed down verbally. And, you know, cultures, we don't really place a lot of emphasis on multi-generational families. Other cultures do, you know, so hearing a story from your grandfather was everything. That was a gift, you know, and that's hard for us to wrap our Western brains around. You know, my father is here today. I would hope that my son sitting in the back knows that that's a gift. But, you know, for other cultures, like, that could have been a birthday present, you know, was sharing my knowledge with you, sharing their knowledge. So I've seen evidence of that, and I think it's sad that we don't have that as much anymore. But, yeah, there are a lot of cultures and tribes where they're really rushing to write things down now, like the Quechua in Ecuador, before the language is lost. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you ask louder?
Sorry.
Better?
Yes.
So the thought that issues that people have doubtfulness about science and everything, I mean, the fact that we have an actual battle plan written by many of the space agencies of how to disclose information if they do find confirmed signs of extraterrestrial life and process to do it properly shows how much they actually have to take it carefully to people who may not want to welcome that information.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's always something that is interesting to me. You know, there's really only two options. Like, we are alone or we're not, and they each have repercussions. You know, they're each kind of equally terrifying. Like, being alone in the universe, that's something. Not being alone in the universe, well, are they hostile? Are they not? Are they going to interpret us as hostile or not? You know, like, would an extraterrestrial culture looking at us now see us as peaceful?
Probably not.
Probably not. Yeah.
There's a follow-up to mention that is that there is an other side of the coin, that is, upon the Apollo 11 mission success, the international reaction wasn't that Americans landed on the moon, is that we landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And so that may be something I'd be really good at looking forward to the Artemis missions that are coming up.
Yeah.
So that can be something that educators can research into.
Yeah.
Remember the Apollo plaque? Said we come in peace for all mankind.
Yeah.
Do any of the cultures or peoples that you've studied or interacted with, they have a heliocentric view of the sky? And did any of them have a heliocentric view rather than geocentric?
No, that's actually a really interesting thing. So many cultures, including my understanding, is many indigenous cultures, especially in North America, did not have a geocentric. They had a heliocentric view.
Really?
It seems to be, from what I have learned, maybe I'm wrong, but like the Maya did not think that the Earth was the center. And I have read that even many ancient Chinese astronomers did not place the Earth at the center. That really the Greeks. What's that?
Please include India in that.
Oh, that's India, I didn't know that.
We have visuals. I know you have not touched on anything Eastern in your presentation, but if you really look at Eastern astronomy and understanding, it's much more advanced than anything that has happened in the Western Hemisphere.
I will make sure to add that to this.
Yes,
thank you for that.
Please
reminder.
Do. I felt like it was a little lopsided, but if you even look at the description of the Earth, there was no question of flat Earth. It was always a spherical Earth. It was heliocentric. The sun had a huge prominence. So I think it's the ancient cultures probably saw and understood better.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've seen too. And that, like, with the ancient Greeks and their idea of this perfect geometry and circles and attributes that they gave to the heavens, and with geometry, that it fit much more their narrative to have an earth-centered system.
Yes, it was more of a narrative rather than.
Yeah. Because it sure didn't fit the observations.
A question, like, so thousands of years ago, a Greek, Eratosthenes, deduced the circumference of the Earth to within a few percent. Why did that idea not propagate? Why did it take so long for us to kind of rediscover?
Too bad we can't ask him. I'm not sure.
it's a good point, though. I mean, I think a lot of people had ideas along these lines in Western cultures, but for some reason, whether it was religion or other things, those ideas were suppressed.
I mean, he did that how many years ago, and people still think the Earth is flat.
Right.
You know?
Right, exactly.
So if you're not familiar, he measured a shadow in Alexandria, and he knew the height of the thing that he was measuring, and was able to calculate the diameter of the Earth.
Yeah, we do that in middle school math classes.
Yeah.
Do that experiment.
Mm-hmm. It's a cool experiment.
It's a cool experiment.
It's a really cool experiment.
I guess, I think it's a myth that most people around the days of Columbus thought the world was flat. But
right.
That's not true.
Yeah.
I've heard that too.
They realized that it was round.
Mm-hmm.
They just thought his numbers were wrong. Because they were wrong.
His numbers were wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He used a too small circumference and thought that you could sail to China in a couple of weeks.
But it's funny because like the point almost remains, because even if you have a spherical geometry like thousands of years before, like the precision on that calculation was like 3%, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yet here we have Christopher Columbus who like got it completely wrong.
Well, he wanted it to be wrong. He was fudging the numbers.
Right.
He never actually set foot in North America.
It's a piece of cake.
Yeah.
Truth.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Truth is not meant to make you happy. It's meant to be the truth. That's the sad reality.
Ask any American if he ever set foot in America.
He
didn't actually set foot in North America. Sorry to crush your dreams if you didn't know that.
An observation, I think we've underestimated the disaster of the destruction of the museum in Alexandria with the Christians rioting on the third time it was destroyed, and how much was lost there. I think because the way we've taught history, we don't understand it. Probably Alexandria was far more important than Rome in its time, and it has been eclipsed because that Greek culture was overcome by Christianity, and then we have the shift. We come from Western Europe, but looking back, it really looks as Alexandria was. It was a total disaster for Alexandria to crumple like that. But are you aware of Hamlet's Mill? Okay, this is a study of ancient astronomy in many, many cultures by Giorgio de Santayana and Hertha von Deschen from 1967. And it discusses the history of the precession of the equinoxes, which cultures knew them and when. Describes the Gilgamesh's search for the water of life as a journey to the bottom of the old sky into Ogygia or Canopus, the star Canopus, which is the center of the circle of the 26,000-year
precession
change, exactly, in the southern celestial hemisphere. So the Kaaba in Mecca is aligned on Canopus. The rising of Canopus, I think it's at the equinox, but I'm not exactly sure. It's worth looking into. I myself have proven that the search for the water of life in Persian, in epics, especially Nizami, is actually a celestial journey into the land of darkness. Because Elijah leaves footsteps green across the sky where he goes after he finds the water of life. It's fascinating stuff, and it's worth incorporating this. I don't think it was accepted by Western academicians in general, but I made an independent study. I haven't been able to publish it yet, but it's very clearly.
What was the name of the book?
Hamlet's Mill. You see, the mill is of Hamlet is the precession of equinoxes, the spin of what the Indians call the skamha, which was the celestial. If you take the precession of equinoxes here and here, and you put a line straight up from the center of the pole of the precession equinox is here, which is empty in the north, but is Canopus at the bottom, you get what's called the Skamha, or the life tree. And it's got all that in there, and it's worth incorporating.
Okay.
Is this a reference to how in the northern cultures, the Sampo, which was meant to be Polaris, was also this male that gave infinite amounts of food? There's a similar story in the north.
I don't remember that one.
Any questions online?
But the Buddhists have it. You can see it from in India. You can see on there's a certain kind of Buddha statue. They got one in the Smithsonian there that has five layers of being, and it's got the Skamha in it as the tree. So it's an ancient thing that was passed down, and you can still see it now in the Smithsonian, in the Sackler Gallery.
I'll have to check that out.
Sackler or Freer
Gallery.
Okay, any questions online?
Question.
If you want to raise your hand or unmute yourself and ask. Okay, I guess not.
I had one last one. This is a real astronomy question. So the inclination of the orbit of Mercury, right, you showed as being more significant than the others. If you look at Mercury, it looks like it's largely a planetary core.
Yes, right? It is.
Is there a connection there? Like, was Mercury hit by another body?
Had to have been. Yeah.
Okay.
So looking at the actual spectroscopy of the surface, it looks to be more of a planetary core. We can also see from its rotation, because its day is longer than its year. So its year is 88 days. Its day is like 120.
Yeah.
So it takes longer to do one axial rotation than it does to do an orbital revolution. So it had to have been hit by something to slow that inertia, to be able to slow it down.
Wow.
But it resembles more of a protoplanet core. It's very iron rich, and it only has a very, very thin olivine layer, which is what we'd associate with a mantle or, the mantle crust boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have anything like the silicates that we would find on a crust. So, it had to have been blasted to bits, which makes sense because it's so close to the sun, you'd have a lot of infalling.
You'd have a lot of infalling.
Yeah, my head kind of said it was the old center of the galaxy.
Yeah, not a question, but just a note. There's one day a year, I think it's even in early March, if I remember correctly, when half the sun crosses a corner of Cetus.
It's today. It's today.
It is today.
Well,
today.
It's
my wife's
birthday, Einstein's birthday, and
so Einstein was a half cetacean.
Yes.
So,
but it's not,
so you could say
it's not nice to call your wife that.
Yeah.
There's a particular.
I think the other fascinating thing with having a Vega as the North Star is that means the entire sky was shifted. So a lot of the constellations
would have been totally different.
Well, not hugely different, but if you actually look at where the constellations are in the sky, there are some that were designated by the Greeks, which are now too low in the sky, but would have been high enough, visible back then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's kind of fascinating to think about. So,
in about 6,000 years, the Carina Nebula will be visible from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, see?
Yeah.
So,
well, also, the precession of the precession of the equinoxes means that the first point of Aries for astrologers, is actually over on the other side of Pisces, the constellation Pisces, heading towards Aquarius.
Well, if there aren't any more questions, let's give Dr. Herschel.
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Big Eye?
Yes.
So.
One more upcoming event. I didn't think of this until after we had started the presentation. Rockville Science Day is coming up on Sunday, April 26th.
Ryan, yeah.
At Montgomery College.
On the floor, is it Mark?
NCA and some other astronomy club.
That's cool.
Okay. Version one, we're in these boxes.
Oh, that's cool. I've tried to have students make those hard.
I can tell you why this is wrong. I've learned this, why this is wrong. But
I will
talk more later.
If I need some measurements, that's good.
Now
we
can do it.
I
just
make
this. You're wearing a t-shirt.
Why am I wearing this t-shirt?
Yeah, don't put
it
out.
Because I still
can
sit
down. Station.
I think it's just the box anyway.
Yeah,
you can measure it.
Yes. Okay,
we're going to stop the recording, I think.
And only 5% of the voting members of IAU voted. I was not one of them because I was waiting. But in my student.